going to talk too loud or I might knock it over and have Sharon all over me. Well, thank you for having me here again. Thank you for the science experiment. That was fun. The last time I was here, I was carrying on with a series that I've been trying to work with you. I know it may be a little hard to manage the continuity, especially given that I wasn't here last month. But the last time I was here, we looked at the woman at the well in the context of our series, Jesus and. And we're trying to see how did these people interact with Jesus and what can we learn from that interaction about how we interact with Jesus and with God. The woman at the well was immediately and convincingly convicted of Jesus' authority. She said to other people, "Come, see a man who told me everything I ever did." But today's reading is a little different. In today's reading, we have a bit of a challenge. Jesus says, "Don't be amazed." This situation is different in that it's going to be a growing experience for Nicodemus, the hero of our story today. And of course, it includes what we usually think of as the most popular, most famous verse in the Bible, John 3:16, which tells us that love motivated God to send his only son because he wanted to bring more of us to be with him. We can think of God as a lot of things. We can think of him as the creator. We can think of him as the ruler of all that's been created. We can think of him as a supreme authority. But first and foremost, he was a father. And he sent his son because he wanted more children. And that's a very important message that Nicodemus and we sometimes take a long time to really wrap around our hearts. John likes to tell his stories with a real dramatic introduction. He likes to tell the story of a person. The word in Greek is anthropos, and you can see where words like anthropology and such come from in our language for that. He starts his gospel, his letter, "In the beginning was the Word." Then he says, "There was a man sent from God whose name was John." And now he begins this story in chapter 3. "Now there was a Pharisee." This morning we read a children's book. But I like the way that John likes to tell things in such a story-like fashion. "Now there was a Pharisee, a man named Nicodemus." So we know that this backstory of this man has to be important. He was a leader of the Jews, part of the Sanhedrin. That was the highest legal body, the highest judicial legislative body amongst the Jews. This was a very important man. And what is John trying to see for us? What is he trying to tell us about these Pharisees? What does he want us to understand about that when he points out very first thing about this guy, that he's a Pharisee? Well, who were they? They prided themselves on knowledge and study and being right with God. Early on in his ministry, if you turn back, in chapter 2, there was a wedding in Cana. And then there was the cleansing of the temple. He claimed that the temple was his father's house. And it says in John 2:23, many believed because they saw the signs he was doing. And then in verse 24, but Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. So John is saying to us that people were following him because he turned water into wine. Because of other miracles that John doesn't even elaborate on. But he says that Jesus knows what's really inside a person, even a Pharisee. And he says Jesus is not going to trust himself to these people if it's only about miracles. And so John introduces this Pharisee, and the audience that John is writing for gets an immediate mental picture of a person who wants to be right with God, but on the other hand, may have been too dogmatic and too unforgiving in the way that they took that. We could compare Nicodemus' situation to the woman at the well, because in the next chapter, he's going to go talk about that woman. There's lots of similarities, but there's lots of differences too. She was of low stature. He's a very elite stature. He was chosen by the people to lead. She was an outcast. She meets Jesus in the light of day, but Nicodemus comes at night. He's not willing necessarily to be seen with Jesus because of what the other Pharisees might think of what he has to say or what he has to do. And Nicodemus comes to him and says, "We know that you are a teacher come from God." He acknowledges Jesus' stature. That's unlike the average Pharisee because they've already... It was interesting when we were talking at the Lord's Supper about how they made their plans to kill him. You're going to see the seeds of that even here, that they're already plotting. So unlike the average Pharisee, there was some openness. And that's the first step that Jesus recognizes in him, that openness that will allow him to talk to this man. And you might think, oh, Jesus is going to use this opportunity to elicit things from this man, to open up a conversation. But as Emeril likes to say, no, bam! He cuts him right off. We don't even know what Nicodemus was going to ask. All he does is says, we know you're from God. And then Jesus says, okay, I'm going to take this right here. Without saying anything negative about his learning or his righteousness, Jesus immediately changes the discussion. He says, very truly, or truly, truly, or verily, in some of the older translations, literally, the word in Greek comes from the Hebrew, and it's amen. It's the word that we use so throw away at the end of prayers. But it means, I am speaking to you. Believe what I have to say because I'm speaking to you from my heart. It's been translated from Hebrew to Greek to English. And it's related to our word, believe. And what does Jesus say? He says, you've got to start over. Never mind what you know. You've got to start all over again. And I can just imagine Nicodemus. Confusion? Dismay? He says, you've got to be born again. He says, how can somebody be born at an old age? And then it's almost comical when he starts to say, how can a man go back into his mother's womb and be born again? It doesn't make any sense. And so he's scratching his head. He just doesn't understand. And so Jesus comes to him and talks in four, what I'll call motifs, and four contrasts about what life is like, the way he's seen it before, and the way Jesus wants him to see it. First of all, he compares the physical and the spiritual. He says, you must be born of water and spirit. And in the Greek, those two ideas are not even separated. They're together. They're both necessary. Nicodemus was concerned physically with how this born-again thing would even work. And Jesus says, no, you need to understand the other part of it, the spiritual part. Birth physically in the flesh makes you part of a nuclear family. Jesus goes deeper and says, birth into the spirit makes you part of God's family. And he goes deeper to try and explain what this spirit is. He says, it's like the wind. We don't see it. We can't pin it down. But we feel it, and we feel its effects. That's what wind is like. If you want to understand what spirit's like, here's a physical example that maybe, Nicodemus, you can grasp. And Nicodemus is no less confused. How can this be? He asks. How are you born from above? For Jesus, the result is in the proof of how you live. We hear the wind rustle leaves or snap a flag. And if it's really strong, we can even hear the roar of the air. But we can't pin it down. God's children are like that, Jesus says. They're about the work that God has for them wherever it takes them. Bob Dylan asks a series of questions that seem unanswerable. He says, how many roads must a man walk down before you can call him a man? How many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? And how many ears must one man have before he can hear the people cry? Dylan says the answers are right there at your fingertips, but they're not something you can see. They're not about the physical. They're about that which is unseen, the truth underneath, the foundational things. For Dylan, the answer is blowing in the wind. For Jesus, these amen statements about his Father's kingdom are where truth lies. And I find that a funny juxtaposition when I was writing that. Truth lies. It's just the way it worked out. But that's something that only the Spirit and those who follow the Spirit can understand. Just like Dylan. You can't pin it down. So Jesus challenges him again. You're a teacher and you don't even understand these things? It's not really a chastisement here. It's rather concern. If you, the teacher, the one who should know, don't understand this, then how is your flock ever going to understand this? How are the people who listen to you? And then Jesus says, we speak. He says, we. Is that the royal we? He's talking about him and his Father because they've always been in such close relationship. To him, it's always we. I've talked about things here on earth changing, and you don't grasp it. How can I tell you about heavenly things? If you can't understand even the things here on earth, how am I going to be able to get across the things of heaven? No one has ever seen it except the one who came from there. That's me. So he says, let me try again. Second contrast, the earthly and the heavenly. The difference between looking to your needs and to your wants, that's the way of the world, and looking beyond to the needs of others, that's the way of heaven. Do you remember Moses in the desert? When the people were sick and dying from snake bites? God commanded that he mount a snake, and when the people looked up, they were saved from their illness and death. It's going to be like that with me. I will be raised up, Jesus says, by people on a cross. Very much a physical thing. But God will raise me up in exaltation, a spiritual thing. And if you look upward to what I'm delivering, you'll live forever. In Moses' case, why were those snakes even there in the first place? If you read the passage, you'll see that it's because the people were grumbling against God and put their selfish desires first. It was good back in Egypt. It really wasn't, but it looked better than that to them. They wanted to be in control themselves. And in this case, Jesus is trying to show Nicodemus a better way. Instead of looking out for your own selfish interest, you need to look out for the interests of others. What follows after that, scholars have debated, beginning in John 3:16. Is this what Jesus said, or is this what John is saying about what Jesus said? I happen to have a red letter NIV here, and they choose to color it white. But yours may be different. We're not sure whether this is Jesus talking or whether this is John talking. Either way, this is the most beloved verse in the entire Bible. If you run into someone with no background in Christianity on the street, it's more likely they'll warm to this verse than any other. I mean, you see it in football games, right? Somebody raises John 3:16. You see it in farmers' fields. You see it on jewelry. Why? Because it demonstrates that God's love acted first and acted for us. God loved and God gave. The Father and the Son had experienced complete and intimate love for all time. Now God's making this available to everyone. To the Jews, that would have meant them. But remember, in the next chapter, he's going to say, this Samaritan woman, she deserves this too. And eventually, it's going to go to the Gentiles, which is, of course, good news for us. So we're reminded that it was not to condemn us that Jesus came. In fact, we were already living under condemnation. Jesus says, we came, he and his Father, to testify. This is almost like a court case in which mankind is on trial for our behavior. We came and we testified. The evidence was heard, and now the verdict was in. And the verdict wasn't good, was it? So the third and fourth comparisons that Jesus makes for Nicodemus: light and darkness, good and evil. The light has come. It's exposed our sin, but mankind would rather hide in the darkness than enjoy the light. Darkness hides, but light exposes. Why do we hide? Because in darkness we can continue in our self-seeking. Jesus says that's a sign of evil winning out. But those who do good, who do what is true and noble, they're not afraid to come out into the light. In fact, they want to show this off, not because it's of their own doing, but because it's pointing to God and recognizing that it's God's goodness that is behind all of this. In 1967, Dr. Christian Barnard performed the first heart transplant. Sometimes the heart becomes too diseased to even be repaired. At that point, the only option is to repair the faulty heart. Sorry, just to replace the faulty heart. Jesus says you must be born anew. To do that, you need heart surgery. The darkness-loving person has to be recreated, a new spiritual being who lives in the light and loves the Father and the fact that he sent his Son. We sing sometimes a song called or a song that reads, create in me a clean heart, O God. take this tired and broken heart and replace it with yours. Not a heart of sinew and muscle, but a heart of love and compassion. A spiritual heart, if you will, that breathes life into our own souls and those around us. So I said John really likes to tell a story. And suddenly, he drops us. Nicodemus is gone. In verse 22, after this, Jesus and his disciples went out. What happened to Nicodemus? Did he walk away more puzzled than ever? Was he still wrestling with this stuff? Did he walk away in awe? Did he walk away wanting more? We don't know. It leaves me kind of wondering. Jesus has just gone out into the countryside. Nobody else is going to hear this message until many years later when John decides to pen it. But fortunately, he isn't finished with Nicodemus' story. We meet him again in chapter 7. Jesus is a very polarizing figure. At Nicodemus' first meeting here in chapter 3, Jesus challenged him to make a choice: flesh or spirit, earthly things or heavenly things, darkness or light, evil or good. And others were obviously feeling that Jesus was calling them to make a choice too. So much so that when we get to him in chapter 7, the people are asking, is he the one? So much so that the Pharisees, even in chapter 7, want him arrested. He's becoming too powerful in the people's eyes. And so the Pharisees send the police to arrest him. And interestingly, they come back in awe and saying, they've never heard teaching like this. But did you arrest them? No, we couldn't do that. So the Pharisees are a little ticked. And as they review it, they fall back on their learning, because that's what they're about. They're a learned group. And I'm paraphrasing rather loosely, but they say, you don't see any of us Pharisees who study and know the law following him, do you? But these unlearned people, they're cursed. The Pharisees' contempt for Jesus is almost palpable. And then one of their own number stands up. John reminds us that it's this Nicodemus who had gone to Jesus looking for understanding. And remember, he'd gone at night. But these other Pharisees have already made their conclusions from afar. They're prejudging Jesus without even really knowing him. Nicodemus stands up all right, but not really for Jesus himself. He stands up for fairness and justice. I mean, it's a step. Remember, he went at night. Now he's going to stand up and say, this isn't fair. This isn't right. He's a voice of reason. He even voices it as a question. We don't condemn someone without listening to him, do we? But the accusers' minds are made up. There's a real foreshadowing here of the mock trial that's going to come later. Their minds are closed to the truth. Their study proves he can't be the one, if nothing else, because no prophet ever comes from Galilee. And I wonder what was going through Nicodemus' heart at this point. Here we go again. He'd listen to Jesus, and he'd probably come away confused. Now here he is again, now defending at least justice. He's not really ready to cast his lot in with Jesus, but he is ready to contest for him that he be given a fair listen. And once again, John does it to us. He drops us. I want to say, wait a minute! What happened? What happened to Nicodemus, who stood up against the entire Sanhedrin? Some manuscripts have an extra verse that says they all went home, as if they're skulking away and they have no footing for their prejudice. But John's just been building in our minds that Nicodemus showed fairness and plants the possibility that Jesus' words are working in his heart. And he has to face these questions that Jesus is putting before him, because Jesus is going to ask for difficult questions to be answered. It's really something for him to step out against the rest of those Pharisees. Fortunately, that's not the last that John deals with Nicodemus. In John chapter 19, after Jesus' death, we see him one last time. John chapter 19, 38, and I'm reading from NIV. Later, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly because he feared the Jewish leaders. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. He was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who had earlier visited Jesus at night. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds. Taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it with the spices in strips of linen. This was in accordance with Jewish burial customs. At the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. Because it was the Jewish day of preparation, and since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. So again, we cut back to the Nicodemus story. He's paired with this Joseph of Arimathea, who is described as a secret disciple for fear of the Jews. And John reminds us that Nicodemus had once been so timid as to come to Jesus at night. But here, both of them take action that leaves no doubt about where they are putting their trust. Joseph goes to Pilate to ask for the body. And Nicodemus brings a pallet load of spices to anoint the body. Both of them gave very expensive gifts. Joseph, his own unused tomb. Nicodemus, a very large quantity of expensive spices for burial. And both are boldly stating their confidence in this Jesus, that he was sent by God to redeem the world. So, wrapping this all up, Nicodemus makes a transition. His story begins in confusion. How can these things be? How can a man change? When we next meet him, he's ready to stand up for what's right. This man needs a fair hearing. But finally, in this situation, he demonstrates a confidence through his action. Jesus has challenged him to choose sides. Is it going to be flesh, or is it going to be spirit? Is it going to be things of earth, or is it going to be things of heaven? Is it going to be darkness, or is it going to be light? Is it going to be evil, or is it going to be good? He's no longer, I don't think, the timid man that came by night. He's ready to submit to Jesus' love and accept him as the gift sent to redeem us. Well, what's the lesson for us? I think the first thing that it says to us is that our maturity must develop over time. We all need to get used to the idea of heart surgery. It's a big deal, and we need to get prepared for it. We need to be prepped, as the doctors would say. We don't learn all of this. We don't take all of this in at one sitting. And furthermore, when we're dealing with the world, we don't need to completely convert those we meet the first time we meet them. We just need to introduce them to Jesus. Yes, he's going to demand a choice. Is it going to be the world way, or is it going to be my way? Is it fleshly? Is it spiritual? Is it worldliness or heavenliness? Is it darkness or light? Is it evil or truth? But there's room for growth. There's room and time for maturity. God was a father first. God was the first father. Love describes that first relationship and all relationships that grow from it. In our reading today, Jesus says, don't be surprised. Don't be amazed. Those things you prided yourself on, while they're honorable, that knowledge, they miss the gift. And the gift is what's important. That God so loved the world, he gave his only son. Love is first and it has to be foremost. Everything else grows from that. Share that and you'll be sharing the very best news with the world.